Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is a CC Radio podcast.
It was just the most massive thing I've ever seen. To tell you the honest truth, I thought, well, we're the only ones left on this planet. Something's happened. We've missed something here.
The fear that went in me when I seen it was just the feeling, I'd say it was fear, but I've never felt that feeling before in my entire life.
It's a weird feeling, like you can't explain it when you don't know. You feel like you're being followed, but you don't know what it is.
We had two to our right, another one in front of us, another one to the left, and another one just across the road, shaking the daylight out of the tree. All we get is a big red eye.
I remember waking up and looking at the end of the bed, and there was a figure there, almost insect-like, and then I blacked out.
Welcome to the show, everyone. You are listening to Believe Paranormal and UFO Radio. My name is Cade Moyer, and thanks for tuning in. If you've had an encounter, get in touch with me. My email address is believe@ccradio.com.au, or you can message me on Facebook at facebook.com/believeUFOradio. If you enjoy this episode, there are a few things you can do to help the show. Firstly, you can go to iTunes and leave us a 5-star rating and review. Or you can share the show around social media with your friends and family, and that would help us grow. Tonight I'm joined by Attila, and a lot of you will remember Attila from his episode where he was stalked by two Yowies in the Blue Mountains. Attila joins us tonight to talk about some UFO activity that he's experienced through his life. Attila, welcome to the show.
G'day, Kate. Thanks for having me again.
Oh, the pleasure is all mine, mate. You've just wrapped up shooting for your movie Track, which is very exciting, the Hunt for Australia's Bigfoot. And I figured, hey, let's get you on to talk about the UFO stories that you kind of teased when you were on here last time.
Sure thing. No problems.
So, mate, what got you into the UFO world?
That's an interesting story on its own. What really spiked my interest was when I was a little kid. We lived out in a place called Kelso, which is out near the Bathurst region. And I had a few encounters out there. And back in the time, and this was in sort of like the late 70s, my mother and father and I used to go for an early evening stroll and sort of look at the night skies and the occasional satellite here and there back in those days. And there were times when we saw lights that appeared to be satellites, but they would stop and take a 90-degree turn and take off with great speed. And that kind of spiked my interest. And there was also an encounter that happened back in those days in the late 70s where a lady was buzzed by a so-called object, a flying saucer-type object. And I started collecting newspaper articles, and I really got into it as a little kid. But it really didn't surface again until a friend of mine or an acquaintance that I had back in 99 who encountered a large saucer-shaped flying craft over a place called Minto, which is in the southwestern side of Sydney. It was quite a well-known case, and it was originally investigated by an investigator called Peter Curry. And Peter ran his own investigative edition back in those days, and because I was, you know, this gentleman was I knew him quite well. He was from a European background, an Eastern European background, and the case was quite big. And a gentleman's name was Laszlo Novak, and this happened in June 1999, and that kind of was essentially the breaking point for me to establish a civil group with a colleague of mine at the time that investigated an identified aerial phenomena.
Yeah, because you were telling me before we got on the air that you and some colleagues started the UFO Society of Western Sydney. So this was
correct.
This was the catalyst for that. And what did you run into when you started this society? I mean, did you kind of get inundated with cases, or were you finding there was a lot of hoaxes going on? What kind of happened when you kind of made this, I guess, an official thing?
This was, I really don't even know where to begin. It was so messy at one point that so much was going on that it sort of went out of control a little bit at a certain stage. But certainly we did receive a lot of hoaxes. At the time, this was in late 99, early 2000, when we established this civil group. And we were actually a member of the Australian UFO Research Network back in the time. And the way things operated back then was that there was a state representative for the Australian UFO Research Network, which was abbreviated as AFORN. And that state representative would outsource the sightings to the nearest investigator of that region where the sighting originated from. And in 2001, we received a horde, and I mean a horde of sightings that was coming from the Northern Beaches in Sydney. And it got so crazy to a point that people were basically seeing the same things. And at one point, we decided to make a conscious decision and actually go out and investigate these things for ourselves, because people were seeing this almost on a daily basis. And the reports came in of clusters of lights that were hovering over, you know, over Narrabeen. There's a lake over at Narrabeen, and the report came from a lady there, particularly a lady who lives near the lake, and she described the cluster of lights that were coming in from the ocean and hovering above the lake and then gradually ascending up over the sky and heading towards Sydney. And as these lights progressed towards the mainland, there were more and more, there was a chain of sightings that was reported, so we were able to follow those chains. So it's almost like a crime investigation scene, because you're collecting reports, you're collecting information and trying to correlate, you know, what was going on and what people were seeing, you know, where they were coming from, and how accurate were the sightings. And obviously we would ring up the people, sometimes go out in person and actually interview people face to face and get detailed descriptions of what they've seen. And Kate, this was a time when what this was actually known as a UFO flap. Those people who haven't heard of that term, a UFO flap is when there's a massive outburst of UFO sightings in certain particular regions. And a colleague and myself, we went out, and this would have been in March 2001, and we went out to Long Reef and Collaroy, looking north towards the central coast. And I had a very old DSLR camera with me, and I set it up and I started doing time-lapse shots. And it was still using the old film system. So it wasn't actually, sorry, it wasn't a DSLR, it was an old SLR camera, an old Pentax. And lo and behold, we saw this light coming in from the ocean, and it was cruising in towards the mainland, and it was gliding like butter on a hot plate, and it was orange in colour. It was some distance away. I estimate it to be at least a kilometre away from where we were. I mean, we were at quite a decent vantage point. And this thing would come towards the mainland, and it would stop near the cliffs, probably a few hundred metres from the cliffs, and would hover there. And so I actually started setting up my camera, started taking photos and time-lapse shots. So, you know, the shutter would be open for about 10, 15 seconds. And this thing would hover there for a few seconds, and then it would actually submerge, dive into the ocean and disappear.
Oh, wow.
And this repeated itself about three or four times. And at one point in time, we could actually see a light in the ocean, in the water, moving with incredible speed.
And this all happened at the same night.
Correct. Yeah, this all happened at the same night. So over about a half an hour, and I actually still recall the time. It was around 8:30 at night. And about half an hour had lapsed, and out towards the ocean, probably about on a 45 degree angle from where we were above the trees, we would see this brilliant light. And we thought, well, it's probably a helicopter coming this way, you know, with its spotlights on. Maybe they saw these things, and maybe they were trying to find out what we were dealing with. I had a small, you know, 2.5-inch sort of little Saxon telescope with me, with a 24mm eyepiece, and I had it set up on a little tripod. So basically what I did is I aimed it at this light, and I got the shock of my life, to be honest. I had never expected in a million years to see what I saw through the telescope, and I saw it in quite significant detail. And this thing, it basically looked like an airplane propeller. So it had three arms. It was on an angle. It had a central core that was glowing, where the propeller or the arms or the wings, whatever you want to call it, would actually meet in the center. And this hub was illuminated orange. And at the tip of the wings, it had like a two-tiered light set up. And it was just sitting there and very gradually rotating. The colleague that was with me actually had a look in the telescope too, and we looked at each other thinking, what is this? I mean, this is I have never even through my studies and going through reports of UFO sightings, I've never ever seen anything like this in my life.
Yeah, I haven't heard of anyone witnessing a UFO that matches that description at all. That's really unique.
It was. And I remember getting up, and I started running towards it, and I tried to get to a more clear area, trying to get close to it. And as I ran, I actually face planted into the mud. But obviously that didn't stop me. So as I was going, I was looking at this light, looking at this. And next minute, there was this intense flash, and it had disappeared. So I kept on running down this dark corridor of shrubbery on this path, and I got to a clearing which looked straight towards the east, overlooking the ocean. And there, out in the distance, there was this brilliant light just sitting on top of the water. And I went back and I collected my colleague and all my equipment, and we went to this other location, and we set the telescope up. And as we tried to look into the telescope, we could hear these helicopters turn up from nowhere. And we couldn't see the helicopters, but we could see the searchlights. So we decided to actually just hide, because we didn't know whether they were looking for witnesses or whether they were searching for whatever this thing was. But there was more than one helicopter. And the strangest thing is we kept looking into the sky trying to find these helicopters, and we couldn't see them. But yet we could see the searchlights on the beach. And lo and behold, once they disappeared, this thing went further out into the ocean, and it was just brilliant light, so we couldn't make any detail of this thing. We rang the Coast Guard up, and the Coast Guard said, yeah, somebody did report a fire out in the ocean. But nobody, obviously they didn't inform us of any other form of, you know, peculiar reports that have came in. I mean, I don't think they would have notified us anyway. So, you know, I rang up the, I was a little bit naive back then. I even rang up air traffic control. I rang up the civil aviation authorities. I rang up every man and his dog that I can possibly get my hands on who would have had some kind of evidence or some kind of report of this sighting. And it wouldn't be until another probably 5 or 6 years later when I received a report from a young lady around the same time who witnessed the same thing when she was coming home at night in the northern beaches in Narrabeen. And she actually saw this object hovering above the houses, and she got so frightened that she ran to her relative's house, and she had keys to the relative's house, and she went in and hid there for hours before she was gay enough to come back out. But that was our very first encounter, which was quite a shocking experience, to say the least.
Absolutely, mate. It really kind of sets the standard for everything going forward, I guess, because, I mean, you've witnessed something quite amazing there, and I would think that's quite the initiation into a UFO hunter's, I guess, trade belt.
I guess so. I mean, it's one of those things that after this, it was almost like trying to feed this incredible hunger that was swelling in the pit of your stomach. You just wanted to know more, wanted to find out more, and it just became a quest rather than anything else. And you know, you become blind to everything else around you, your family, friends, and you just have this one goal, and then it's just to pursue this blindly, no matter what and what the consequences are. And you kind of look back years later thinking that, you know, well, it was a stupid thing to do at the time, but I guess it was the person who I was, and everybody gets affected by, you know, everybody gets affected by sightings differently when they have their first major encounter. And I know for a fact that this old fellow, Laszlo, he spent most of his time on top of his roof was with telescopes and video cameras trying to film that opportunity that when they would come back for him, because his story was that he was allegedly abducted by the occupants of the craft that was hovering above the Heath Street, and there were six independent witnesses, which made it quite a strong case. So it affects people differently, and I've seen it over the years how it does affect people.
It's funny you say that, because I was only talking to another podcasting friend of mine earlier today just about this exact thing, how some people have these absolutely amazing encounters, and they'll have it with other people around them. So there's a group of people, and what happens is some people will be blown away by what they've just seen, and some people just really shut up and recluse into themselves, because everything that they believe is probably being changed in a split second once they see one of these things, and they just don't want to believe it happened.
Well, that's right. That's right. I mean, it took me weeks, and I remember sitting at work, and I was in real estate at the time, and I remember sitting in the office for weeks and trying to digest what I had saw, because I didn't want to believe it myself, what I actually seen, because it was so incredible that to be able to witness something like this was almost like an episode of the X-Files or a science fiction movie. I mean, things like this. I mean, I knew that there were things out there, but not to this level. We continued our pursuit, and we had many other sort of quite interesting encounters after that as well.
Do you mind telling us about those? Because I could imagine after an encounter like this, you just really go down the rabbit hole and you start searching everywhere for, I guess, the next big thing.
Well, that's right, and that's right. And it wasn't until a few months later we established two groups of people. We had a team down at who were members of this civil group at the time, and we sort of said, all right, guys, what we need to do is we need to sort of spread out a little bit and communicate with one another and see if something does happen, and see if we can get if depending on where the sighting was, if one team member would get a better view than the other one, because sometimes things happened at a distance and you'd start to think, well, wow, you know, it would be really good to have either another team member out there or something else that could, you know, get a better view of what we're seeing. And we actually did that. So we had a team established down at Long Reef, Collaroy, just a bunch of people who were also interested in this particular subject. And we were situated further up and quite close to the central coast, but still on the northern beaches on the cliffs there at Bilgola. And we were sort of sitting on the cliffs there and basically just looking into the horizon and just waiting. It really is a waiting game. And, you know, you would spend months and months out there and not see anything. And this particular year was quite significant to us because quite frequently, almost every time we went out, something did happen. We end up witnessing something incredible or something that we regard as unconventional in nature. So when we were over at Bilgola, I had a brand new Sony handy camera with me. So I was able to sort of switch between day and night vision. And we was there at the cliffs and sort of looking out, and it was getting dark, and lo and behold, we saw something coming from the ocean heading towards a cliff, and it was pretty much a very similar encounter we had back a few months prior to that, when I actually took a picture of this glowing object of some kind that it submerged into the ocean, and this thing was actually coming towards us. And it was below us because we were high up on the cliffs, and this thing would have been only a few meters off from the water. And this would actually get fairly close to the cliffs, so we got quite a good view, and it was very, very brilliant. And we picked up the mobile phones, and we started bringing the guys down at Collaroy and telling them, guys, are you seeing this from your point of view? And yes, we're seeing this. The phone's cut off. I got my brand new camera out, fully charged battery, everything else, and I pointed it at the object and switched on to record, and the damn thing wouldn't switch on. And here I am in completely flustered and angry, trying to press record to record this thing. And I literally turned away from the object, and the damn thing just automatically turned on. And as it did, this thing just flared up and shot up into the sky and just vanished.
Wow. So do you think this object was affecting your equipment?
Absolutely. There's no doubt whatsoever. Our phones cut off. We had two cameras there. We had an analog camera there.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And my new digital camera, and none of the cameras would function. And funny enough, the analog camera only recorded audio, not vision.
Really?
Yes.
Wow, that's interesting, because I can imagine if there was maybe it put out an EMP field or something like that maybe just knocked out the electronics, but for it to only knock out the video on a digital the analog camera, not the audio, that kind of puts that theory to bed, really.
Well, if there was a strong electromagnetic pulse or field in that area, I mean, depending on how intense it is. If it's intense enough, it would definitely fry the circuits on anything that's electronic. So I don't know. I really don't know how to answer that question, Cade, because it was quite a peculiar incident.
And that also happened to the other group that was there with you, further away.
Well, they were on the phone, so it didn't affect them, but our phones cut out on our end and the video cameras would not function.
Wow, okay. And could they see everything that was happening?
They could see the brilliant object because they were probably about 5 kilometers away from where we were, maybe two as a crow flies. It's hard to determine. I'd have to measure it, mate, to be honest. So it was from Bilgola to Long Reef, Collaroy. So I'd say probably about, let's say, 5 kilometers. So they could see this brilliant light hovering above the water from their perspective. From our perspective, this thing was virtually in front of us and below us, only about 100 meters from the side of the cliff, and it was just hovering there. No sound, no nothing. And that's a creepy part of it, Cade, is that this thing would hover there and there was no sound whatsoever.
Yeah, that's incredible. Is it putting off any heat or anything like that? Is it giving off anything other than the light to let you know that it is there?
Well, I don't recall. I really don't remember if there was any heat. I was in the moment, to be honest. I think the adrenaline was pulsing through my veins with great volume. You know, I was there to actually document this thing, and that was my purpose at the time. And I wasn't able to do that, and I was very, very angry after this thing left.
It's a hard thing, isn't it? Because I mean, you go there, you have all the gear, you're ready to go, and it's kind of like they're one step ahead of you.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
And that would be incredibly frustrating. I mean, you have the audio, but I mean, with an encounter like that, you want the pictures, you want the video, you want You want that actual, that proper evidence.
Exactly. And that was the whole point of going out there, is to display the findings to a public audience and to try to understand what we're actually dealing with.
And those situations, they're really, really hard to explain to, I guess, a non-believer, because you can say, I was in this fantastic moment. I saw this thing that was absolutely unbelievable, and it did something to our equipment, and I can't show you what happened.
Well, that's right. That's right. And, you know, there's been countless cases where people have actually had electronic equipment fail, their motor vehicles stall, and other forms of, you know, devices that were, you know, electronic would be affected by an encounter. And we weren't immune to that at all.
It must be one of the hardest things to deal with as an investigator in this field.
Well, that's correct. That's correct. We try to come up with different ideas, and this is the time before drones. So we were trying to get our hands on, you know, remote control helicopters and something that was big enough to carry a decent payload, a video camera. If something were to emerge or to show itself in an area where we could actually fire this thing, and the whole plan was to launch this thing and get it closer to the anomaly. But knowing after that, you know, electronic equipment get affected by such encounters, that plan was completely useless. So we tried to come up with different ideas.
So what are some of those other ideas? I mean, do you kind of give the off-site crew the same type of equipment to potentially capture what you're seeing from a distance where it might not be affected?
Look, the type of equipment that we tried to bring in were things like scanners. I mean, you know, we were running a civil group at the time, so trying to buy equipment was very, very difficult because of a limited budget that we had. And the budget that we actually had was raised through, you know, public meetings and conferences that we organized over the years. And anything that remained in the society was actually put into buying equipment. And one of the equipment was scanners. And the reason why we felt that was important is that if we did have an encounter, we would listen in onto the scanner from any kind of radio or from air traffic control, regardless where they were, and trying to see if they received a report from a pilot or from another aircraft, or if they were actually seeing the craft themselves. And what I was interested in is the way the information was conveyed and reported to air traffic control. We did hear a number of aircrafts report unidentified craft within the vicinity, but I mean, that could also be an unregistered aircraft. So it doesn't necessarily mean that there was a UFO, an unidentified flying object of the kind that we were witnessing, but it could have been an unregistered aircraft. So it was very difficult at the time. And you know, thermal imaging cameras, obviously, where there was no way in hell we could have got our hands on anything like that at the time. So basically what it was hands-on stuff, trying to make things, use telescopes, try to mount, video cameras onto telescopes. And these were some of the tools that we used. Quite crude, but they did work nonetheless, and especially out when we had one of our first expeditions in 2001 out at Hill End.
And it's things like that, because you just look at the encounter that you just had there, the one that you just spoke about, and all your high-tech equipment just means nothing in that moment.
Definitely. Yeah. That's an accurate way of putting it.
So those two encounters are simply amazing. Does that really cement these things are real? These things are from out of this world. What's your opinion on these, I guess, this aerial phenomena after these two encounters that you've had that almost seem like these are back-to-back if we're looking at that timeline?
Almost. Look, I think with anything that is falls into the realm of the unexplained, and especially if you dig deep enough, that you can bump into some very sensitive content. But the thing is, though, is the deeper you dig, the more answers you have, the more questions, you have, and not enough answers. And you, when you think that you have found the answers, more questions come into place. Sure, it's very quick to jump to conclusions and be hopeful about, an explanation. And no matter how fantastic it might sound, but at the end of the day, one needs to keep a level head and really think, well, what I just witnessed, how does that prove to me that this thing is either A, from, another form of intelligence, or from another planet, or is it something that has been made by us? Is it just purely a terrestrial object, an experimental object by a contracted company that might be doing something for either for the military or for high altitude exploration? Who knows? It's very, very hard to put the finger on a one specific answer.
Yeah, no, of course. And you said there just before that, you started to get into, territory where it was almost, it sounded like you were alluding to, you're kind of stumbling across something that you shouldn't be. Is that something that you're able to kind of give us a little bit more insight onto? Is that more so you're leaning into, government contracts that you're not supposed to have any insight into? You're kind of stumbling across, experimental craft or experimental technology. Is that kind of what you're trying to allude there?
Yeah, it's I'll give you an example of what actually happened without naming any names or anything like that. In 2003, we had a conference out in Campbelltown, and one of the visitors that we had at the conference, he wasn't a guest speaker or anybody else, was a well-known person at the time who was part of a movement in America. And this person was accompanied by an Australian, and they sat in and into the conference and paid attention to the guest speakers and what they were obviously presenting. And my big goal at the time was to invite national speakers and to see if they can talk about their recent work and whatnot. And we did recognize who this person was, and very quickly one of our colleagues took the opportunity and decided to interview this person. And the interview went on in a separate room, and one of the representatives of the staff at the time was outside at a break, and there was a white van that was sitting outside of the conference room with a satellite dish and darkened windows. And this all sounds like very cloak and dagger. It all sounds like an X-Files movie. I can assure you that this actually happened. And this staff member actually came to me and brought it to my attention that there was this van outside that looked very suspicious, and we didn't know who it was, what it was. There was no markings on the site, so it wasn't any kind of network or anything like that. It was purely a white van, quite a new van with a satellite dish and darkened windows. And that van was there up until the point until the interview ended and the van disappeared. And really? The tape was acquired by this colleague of ours, and it obviously had the interview there, and the person of interest vanished for about a week, maybe two.
You're kidding.
And when the person reemerged, I received a phone call saying that the tape had sensitive information, that it had to be confiscated, and it had to be destroyed.
Wow.
And if the tape wasn't returned, then, you know, there was a this person didn't threaten us directly, but he did insinuate what would be the consequences if we weren't going to return the tape.
Wow, things get very real very quickly in that kind of situation, don't they?
They do, and this went on for a little while, and it became quite a messy point where things started getting out of hand a little bit. But eventually all tapes were confiscated and were eventually destroyed. So it just gives you an indication as to how sensitive this particular topic is. And, you know, if there are people out there who have been doing this for quite some time, they will understand what I'm talking about. And it may seem quite incredible for those people who haven't actually ventured into this field, but you can touch on some sensitive topics. So you just need to be very, very careful of what you do and who you talk to and what information you disclose to the public.
So a situation like that comes up, what happens to your mindset? Do you feel like you want to knuckle down even harder, or do you feel like you just need to take a back step and kind of reevaluate things?
Well, I was stupid, so I decided to knuckle down harder.
Of course.
It got to a point where the meetings that we were conducting in Campbelltown at the time, there was a male and a female professional outside this meeting hall, and they were very well dressed, and they were taking all the number plates down who were parked there. And when they approached, these two people got into a motor vehicle and disappeared. So things kind of escalated after that, and it got to a point where I just decided, look, enough's enough, and that was it.
Did you step out of the the investigation world after that?
I did. There were many. Look, this was probably the main reason why, and also I started pursuing film more heavily, and that's where sort of my interest laid. I was more of an investigative journalist rather than, well, that's what I basically turned into, rather than an investigator of the unexplained.
And did you ever feel in danger after, I guess, those threats were made? Well, I don't even know if they were threats, because I wasn't there, but I'm just presuming that they might have been a little bit forceful with the people involved. Did you feel instant relief after you got out of that field?
Oh, hell yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. It was a major relief. You know, it's very hard to put it into context. When you've been pursuing something so blindly for so long, and then you wake up and smell the roses, you then realize that, you know, what you've done over the years and how it's affected yourself and your family. You know, it's you just take a deep breath and exhale, and that exhale is nothing more than a sigh of relief. It's almost like waking up from a coma, and that's how this topic affects you. It's almost hypnotic.
It can really take over your whole world, and it really becomes a part of who you are by the sounds of it, because
absolutely.
The whole search for the truth is, that's what everyone wants. That's what everyone wants to know. And when you become so ingrained in that lifestyle, it probably consumes you.
It does. It does. Blindly. Like I said, you know, nothing else exists outside of that. You have this goal and you set your mind to it, and you're constantly hunting it, you're constantly out looking for it. And you know, you think back as to what's the point in doing it, you know, what was the purpose for doing all this? You know, I didn't get any answers out of it. I've got more questions rather than answers.
Yeah.
I think the benefit that I got out of it, it sort of opened up a whole different dimension of our own existence, of a whole different world that exists within a world. And I'm not talking about aliens or demons or anything like that. I'm talking about merely of other things that exist that not many people are aware of, and a lot of people will probably never experience in their lives, but it does exist. It's there. I'm happy I actually stepped away from all that.
And do you think, just before we wrap up, do you think you'll ever go back to that world?
Never. Not a chance. I'm quite happy being a filmmaker, documentary filmmaker.
Is it because you found everything that you've needed to find in that world, or is it you just don't want to go back to the dramas that it was?
Look, I mean, that's a question that I don't even know what the answer is to. You know, it's all I can say is that I've seen enough and I've experienced enough. I don't know if it was enough for my old self to be content with what I was looking for, but all I know is that when I look back of all those years of what I did, and really I basically came full circle, is I basically started out knowing very little, having no answers, and going back and ending with this thing with no answers again.
Yeah. Yeah, there's not much there to really pull you back there.
No, definitely not.
Well, Attila, on that note, I want to thank you for coming on to the show again, mate.
Oh, I haven't spoken about this for quite some time, you know. So it happened such a long time ago that, I don't really talk about this a lot. But I guess, look, sometimes you just need to put the past onto a dish and just share it with other people, and hopefully other people can either relate to it or understand and maybe even learn from it, as to where to go and where not to go, and where to look and where not to look.
Absolutely. I think that's there's a couple of takeaways from tonight's episode that I think it will speak to a lot of people in a lot of different ways. So I really appreciate you coming on and telling these stories and kind of reliving those moments in your life that may not have been the easiest moments to talk about again. And that's going to do it for tonight. And remember, if you have had an encounter, get in touch with me. My email address is believe@ccradio.com.au, or you can message me on Facebook, and that's facebook.com/believeUFO radio. Until next time, stay safe, and you've been listening to Believe, Australian Paranormal and UFO Radio.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.